first of all, let's talk about the new deal that you and Chip have signed with Cleopatra Records for the back catalog. How did that come about?
Well, actually, Chip and I hadn't been talking, and there was kind of a feud going on, some bullshit, and I'm going to let that lie for a while. And then he got a hold of me and told me that that Cleopatra Records, or I guess they were interested in, first of all, I think Dissonance Record, and then we did that deal with them, and then they said they were interested in the whole back catalog, and that we thought that was great because those records are scattered around and all these shitty little labels. We've never received a penny for any of those records or anything like that. No accounting for them, you know what I mean? And don't even know who to, you know, these shitty labels want to buy that label. Somebody else will buy that label. So you have no way to, you know, especially without a manager that really knew what he was doing, and which I have now, but... But so they made an offer for that. We had an option of selling all the songs outright or doing a licensing deal. We chose the licensing deal, and they're doing box set. They're releasing each one, I guess, individually. And next one is Peach Fuzz, and they already released Dissonance, and that sold out. And the next thing, I'm not sure. I think it's Peach Fuzz and then box set. They're also talking to me about doing my whole solo catalog as well, which works out for me because then I have everything I've done under one roof.
Now, you recently distanced yourself from Decca Records as far as your solo catalog is concerned. What led to that?
Well, the only reason I took that deal in the beginning originally was because of we went for the pledge campaign, and the pledge worked out really great. I raised like twice as amount of money that my budget was or the goal, and but then pledge, I'm not sure if you know what happened. Pledge just took everybody's money and just split and disappeared, and so I'm sitting there holding sitting there over $20,000 in debt plus all of the pledgers that are, you know, pledged, and they, you know, each of them is supposed to get a record, autograph this and that, and there's quite a few of them. So this deal was proposed to me, and the original conditions were that they were going to initially, right off the bat, print up all of those CDs for the fans and get those out. And things started changing with them and their wording and stuff like that, and you know, they really didn't do shit. It's like, you know, it's just what they do, print it on plastic and just put it up on the various different sites and stuff, which is no more than I could, you know, I could do that, and all you need is an LLC. So the record just, you know, it didn't get a good setup, it didn't get a good push. We were just getting ready to go out and play out and support it, and the pandemic hit, and so I had a single ready to go right when the pandemic hit, and it was called Party Time. And because I fulfilled my obligation with them, because the contract was only for the Beautiful Things album, so I was like, well, I want to release a single because I'm, you know, I don't know what to do about an album right now because they don't have any budget money, and I'm, you know, looking around at some other labels and stuff. And for right now, I think I can release a single, you know what I mean, and on a 45, a vinyl 45. And so that was the plan. They released the B-side first, and it just as if it didn't even exist. There was a sister label in Japan that came with them. They did nothing to help us with communications and getting things worked out with the Japan, and Japan sold their whole thing for also, you know, just like Beautiful Things did, and they weren't helping, they weren't doing anything. And then we're going to release the Party Time single like two or three times, I believe, and I had to pull it. And pull it back, pull it down off everything. And then the last time, we're getting ready to release it, and all of a sudden this video came to be, and a very, very, very great video. And so at that point, I decided that this song, this is the most commercial, marketable song I've ever written, and this needs a real fair shot with the video and everything. And so I I pulled it back again, and they gave me a big hassle about that and saying there's going to be fines and this and that. And I said, you know what? I have no fucking deal with you guys anymore. I said, I want my, I want out of that Beautiful Things. So I paid them off for that. And then the Party Time was already all printed on 45s. You know what I mean? It was with the jacket and everything ready to go and listed. It was up on Amazon. It was up on everybody and had to be pulled back down. And so I had to buy all of those 45s as well. Because I know that it would just be a waste to put that song out on that label with no backing, no help, no nothing, and not able to do anything else on my own. And so I just decided, you know, fuck these guys, man. I said, I'm buying out of this. And while I was at it, I had my manager go around and we collected back and bought back all of my solo records that were scattered about. And so now I own every single thing I've ever done. And that's basically why I did that.
That's got to be an incredible feeling for you at this point in your career.
Well, it's a great feeling to know I own all my stuff. It's also, you know, I mean, if something's only as valuable as what somebody that wants it, you know, will pay. So, I mean, it can be as little as worth nothing, or it can be worth something. And you know, just one single away, you know, even with all the Enough's Enough shit and everything, it's just one marketing fluke or something like that, and away from, you know, Chip and I being, you know, zillionaires owning all our shit and everything like that, our publishing and everything. And so it is a good feeling knowing I have all my stuff. It's cost me a fortune to get out of that, get out of those deals. And I mean, two-thirds of everything I collected on that licensing, my half of the licensing deal, and I thought it was money well spent, and a lot of it went into the video as well, because it's a big-time fucking video. It's really, really, you know, pro shot, and it's funny, and it's got a lot of storyboard character, and you'll have to see it, and you'll understand. We're just about done editing it, and now we're looking around and going around to seeing what our options are for promoting, whether we're going to get a big firm or some connections that we have from the past, or if the label wants to do it. But, you know, I would like to own that one just for the reason those, like I said, it's really the most marketable song that I've been trying to write my whole career. And when you hear it, you'll understand why. And so it would, you know, my value and worth, especially going around for solo catalog deals and maybe and possibly a new record deal, because I have the material, I'd become a lot more valuable after this thing gets some business. And I'm sure if it promoted right, this video and this single is going to, you know, at least bring us to a different level. And so, yeah, it's cool.
Who was the creative catalyst behind the video for Party Time?
His name is Todd. What the hell is his name? Todd Causley. When we first came out, he started out as our limo driver and became, he owned a limo company and became like really good friends and sort of like family. And I hadn't spoke to him for like over 20 years. And when I announced that I was shooting a video, and I was originally going to do like the fans participation video, you know, where fans send in little clips or this and that of them partying and stuff. And I put that up on there, and he just got a hold of me, and he said that he's been recently he just shot a movie or a documentary with Michael Madsen and then some commercials for like Goodyear and this and that, which meant that he owned all the equipment and, you know, had the camera guys and had the whole thing and the sound stage and everything. And he basically had a vision at first, and somehow the original idea came up because I had another friend that has the 1989 Batmobile, and he offered to let that in the video. And so I was talking about that, and Todd, one of his side things that he does is he's promotion for this Claremont Collection Auto Museum, and they have the original 66 Batmobile in there and the Bat Cycle and stuff, and we started talking about that and that whole idea coming about. And so it's like a spoof on the 66 Batman show, and he had like the vision. I had some vision as far as you know, the performance scenes and things like that, and some of the storyboard in the beginning of the video, as it starts out with like a little bit of a little mini movie before the video starts. And as we got rolling and into it more, you know, my input became greater, and then everybody's ideas started really flowing in it. But I would have to say he's the director and producer.
At this point, realistically, what are your commercial expectations for Party Time once it's officially released?
Well, hopes and expectations are a dangerous thing I've found in my life, because every time I've had any, you know, with the there's the flip side of positive coming out of hope and expectations on the positive side. There's the flip side of that, which is heartbreak and more, you know, more just, it can be very, you know, it's just not good for the emotional and the psychological. So I don't really have a lot of hopes, but I do have more hopes and expectations for this song than I've had of anything else that I've done since, you know, like the first record or Strength or something on the major labels, because this video is, I'd say, better than the original videos. And so I do have some hope for it. And if we got the right people working with it and promoting it and getting it out there and advertising it and stuff, that I believe that there's no way that it wouldn't do some business, and then, you know, result in possibly, my goal is going for like a commercial, like for, there's a lot of things that you could use Party Time for, like a beer commercial, a booze commercial, a Benegans commercial, a Super Bowl commercial or something like that. It's really, I can possibly send you the song. You can hear it before anybody else gets to hear it. Maybe if I can find it and figure out where it's at in my thing, I can send it to you so you can hear. So hopes and expectations is hopes, more hopes. Expectations is contingent upon what kind of decisions we make and who helps and where, what route we go with it. In that case, I really believe highly in the song.
Without having heard it yet, do you feel that this continues in your power pop direction?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's definitely went its step into, I always try to evolve and continue to hit different ground, whether it's heavy or light or whatever style of the music. The songs dictate the terms for me. I let the song tell me what it is. And I constantly, you know, it's at, usually in a new batch of songs, there will be, you know, they'll tell me what they want to be. And so the records are always different. Party Time has gone back to a slightly heavier edge than the Beautiful Things record. So, you know, just like a lot of the new material that I have sitting in back catalog is slightly heavier edge. Not real heavy, not like heavy metal or anything like that. It's just, you got to hear it, you'll understand. It's very in your face. And I actually went and retracked it, the version that we were going to release after the video got made and everything. I was listening to the original mix. I was like, well, this was kind of done, you know, really low budget and this and that. So I retracked the song and actually went out and got Chip to play bass on it, who's also in the video. And I got Roger Joseph Manning from Jellyfish to play the keys and the brass and all that stuff, and just retract a lot of shit. And I retract all my guitars and stuff, so it's really pounding, man. It really grooves, and it's like night and day. The song just came to life, you know. I got Mike Tholen that did the Beautiful Things to remix it.
I always felt the hair metal, glam metal moniker that you kind of got labeled with right around the debut is kind of unfair, really. The power pop at this point makes a lot more sense.
It was, It was really not our call to make. We were very young and very new to this whole. I mean, Derek and Vic had been in the business for a while, and once, you know, and the original Chip and I's original vision was not anything like metal. It was way more the power pop thing, Cheap Tricky, Squeeze, whatever, you know what I mean. And then Derek and Vic got brought into the mix, and their look, along with their sound and stuff, we kind of got etched in stone with those guys coming into the band. And there's several reasons why they ended up in the band, but I really didn't have my gut feeling was telling me this isn't going to have longevity. This is dating us, you know. It's getting kind of pigeonholing us, and then especially with the labels' lack of help with or lack of thought into the styling and promoting the band and things like that. Because, you know, labels, what they'll do is they'll just take whatever is, you know, nowadays the labels, they take whatever is doing business, just like any product, and churn out more of that. You know what I mean? So that's where their head was at. And it did really good for a year, you know, until all of that changed, and it was in with the good, out with, in with the old, or, you know, in with the new, out with the old. And it was just that glam and that heavy metal type thing that we got branded with that made the difference between us, like us talking today from my private jet. You know what I mean? And with longevity and lasting, you know, it's like Tom Petty or somebody like that, where they continue to, it's not affected by the times, it's not affected by this and that, it's that artist, you know, and everything they do, no matter when it is or what time, as long as it's great, they continue to be that artist, and they continue to you know, I mean, sell and have their fan base and it growing and stuff. And that really, I believe, would have happened had we not made that move. But we jumped on the first thing that, you know, when you got a record label, when you're broke and starving and you're a young kid and you got a record label that offers you like $12 million for 8 records right off the bat, who, you know, it's hard to walk away from that on principle and say, well, you know, I don't believe in this and that. And so it was a big party and we just enjoyed the run, but, you know, obviously it took its toll on me with my not being very fulfilled and believing very much in it. So I just kind of went off into party land, you know what I mean? Plus my anxiety and stuff, it was difficult.
On a more positive note, I understand you were recently reunited with your Purple Les Paul.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's fucking crazy. I had to sell it. I was married out in L.A., and it was the first time I was out of Enough's Enough for a while, a couple of years, and I was a witness, and our landlord in our building lived in a bottom floor of a mansion, had murdered a hooker, and I was a key witness in that, and so that whole household got shut down, and we were kind of, there's no security deposit coming back or anything like that, and, you know, it was just my wife working, and I would just get little chunks here and there from little solo records and stuff. And we were broke and had nowhere to go without on the street. And the one thing, you know, I've had a lot of endorsements and things like that, but I never hung on to them or cared about them. And this guitar was, from the first day that I played it, was recording in the Animal Sessions. It's the only thing I've ever played, you know, except if something broke a string or something like that. It's the only thing I ever played. And it was like an extension of me. And I knew that I went through the Enough's Enough fans and stuff to sell it, because I knew it would be worth more to them. And there was a fan that paid pretty good money for it. And so I did sell it. And, you know, and the deal was that he'd let me know if he was ever going to get rid of it. So I had the first option, and because so I knew where it was and everything. And and I had heard something not so long ago about it, but I still, as soon as I came into the money, like I said, I had to put that all into buying back my records and this and that, so it was going to be postponed again. And I pretty much had, it was way in the back of my mind as probably not going to see this guitar again, but at least it's being appreciated and loved somewhere in a glass case. And I don't know what happened. I don't know how she found out about it. I don't know what went down. It was on Christmas. Christmas morning, I come upstairs and there it was. And I was like, holy fuck, man. Here it's sitting right next to me, 2 feet from me right now.